This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It's been a good week. I'm on a modified schedule right now where I'm going to be going in on Monday. Obviously, I didn't go in on this last Monday because it was Labor Day. But next Monday, I'll be going in. And then through the week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, I'm actually going to be home, working from home. That all seemed to work out fine. So we're going to be doing this modified schedule because the client that I work for is trying to reduce the density in the building, in their main building and in all of the offices, and in that way help keep their employees from getting COVID. So it's an interesting time. But everything is puttering along, so that's good. We're having lots and lots of fun with the costumes. I'm just slogging through trying to get the Grammarly edit done on book 13. Wow, I got a little discouraged last night. I decided I wanted to have the Grammarly edit done by Friday morning, go and do grocery shopping, come home, work on cover. I do have a dentist appointment Friday afternoon, so I gotta get the grocery shopping done, get home, start work on the cover, gotta put everything back on, go. I got tickled because I got a call from the doctor's office, the dentist's office, he was confirming, you know, going through all the COVID questions, blah, 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 doing the thing, you know, and I'm like, nope, haven't had that, nope, we're good. And as he was talking, he was saying, and, you know, I think he said Dr. K or the ladies in the office or something. Anyways, they wanted to let you know that, you know, if you wanted to wear a leprechaun outfit or wear any kind of outfit, you're just welcome to do that. I'm telling you, this thing, it's amazing. It brings such joy to women. And it's just so fun. So it is Uncle Sam Day tomorrow. And I've got a crazy Uncle Sam costume. Uncle Sam Day is actually the 13th of September. It is the birthday of Sam Wilson, who was the inspiration for Uncle Sam. Sam Wilson was a butcher, I think in New York. And the United States, of course, formed up in 1776, Declaration of Independence, all that sort of thing. It did have a mascot initially. The goddess Columbia was the United States mascot. I don't know if the goddess Columbia was ever official, but it was recognized enough that the capital of the United States is called the District of Columbia. And that's because of the goddess Columbia. Sorry, I ate a bunch of stuff to come off my fast just before I turned on the radio. Turned on the recorder. So there was this mascot. There's also Lady Liberty, the Brother Johnson, something. There's been a few other little mascots. But Sam Wilson, during the War of 1812, was a butcher, was supplying the U.S. troops with meat, wrote on the outside of his boxes, his crates, as he sent it, U.S. for the United States. People started saying, oh, hey, your Uncle Sam sent some, whatever, you got some another gift from your Uncle Sam. How U.S. turned into Uncle Sam and not Uncle Smith and not Uncle whatever seems to be lost to antiquity. There is a possibility, because earlier than that, in the 1770s era, I've got to look this up for sure, earlier than that, There is a nursery rhyme that has the phrase Uncle Sam in it. But from the sources I read, they don't think that at that time he was actually considered to be a mascot. And instead, it was just, you know, Uncle Sam. So there might have been, in the common vernacular, this idea of an Uncle Sam that was then got connected to U.S. and then, because, you know, the initials are exactly the same and human brains sync together on that type of stuff, perhaps it got synced up, Uncle Sam took off. It's interesting because the guy who popularized it was a political cartoonist and a satirist. And in fact, his goddess Columbia was in these editorial cartoons that he did as well. And the goddess Columbia was always the person that he used to personify the best parts of America. Whereas Uncle Sam was the personification of the government and was often confused and some would say racist. So it's really interesting that Uncle Sam took hold like it did. But as we went along, there was more and more things, and of course there was wars, and then there's the I Want You, Uncle Sam and the poster, blah, 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 and here we are. It's Uncle Sam Day. You know, I have a crazy outfit for Uncle Sam Day, and people will laugh. It will be good. A good time will be had by all. I did mention this in my reactions video for Labor Day, but it bears repeating. It's really fascinating. I've told a few people, may have mentioned it on the podcast, that one of the things that these costumes do is in some quarters, for some people, they put me in a place of scorn. It's not necessarily bad to be scorned. Sometimes we're so worried about what others may say about us or about think about us that becomes crippling. So to experience a little scorn and to think on your feet and to stay upright, that's not too bad. Typically, when that has happened, it has been older gentlemen who have a very rigid evaluation of the world and who should be doing what and how they should be dressing. But I had one of those little encounters with scorn during the Labor Day costume. And it happened to be a hysterical, I just bust out laughing. I had been in Walmart, going through Walmart. I don't know how many people I had talked to and laughed and people taking pictures. And, you know, there are dozens, maybe as many as 100. I don't know. Dozens. Having a great time. We're just having a great time. Everyone seems to be enjoying it. For those of you who haven't seen the Labor Day costume, I should describe it very quickly. I made a muscle suit with the help of my beloved and her best friend from college. So it was a full body muscle suit, you know, with big muscles. I had that, and then I had a spaghetti strap top that was We Can Do It, Rosie the Riveter. I had Daisy Patriotic Daisy Dukes shorts on, and then shoes that looked like they had graffiti painting on them. So, I mean, it was fun. And I was talking about the American worker, how strong the American worker is, like that and like that. And, you know, people are laughing, we're carrying on. So I'm in the checkout line, and I'm talking to the person who's there, the person who's checking me out. And I'm talking as well to a couple of other Walmart workers. One of the young ladies had asked me, she said, "So, do you find it hard to come up with holidays every week?" And I said, "Well, no, there's a calendar, National Calendar Day, and I just go out there and see what's out there." I said, "I do have to pick. I do have to find the right ones. I have a quirky sense of humor, and I always want to get something that I can do something with that will be fun." By the way, I found out a new one. First week in December is International Day of the Ninja. So, so that'll be fun. So I was talking to them about that. Getting ready to check out. Got all the stuff together, getting ready to check out. And from behind me, over my right shoulder, I hear the clack of cowboy boots. And I can tell from the cadence, the sharp, staccato, quick cadence, that it's a woman. And so I get my stuff in the tubs, and I just kind of glance that direction. She's looking at me. She's grinning. She says, "I love this." I said, "Happy National Labor Day," or "Happy Neighbor Day." She said, "Well, I love this." And as she's walking away from me, she starts saying out loud, some would say yelling, "F yeah, F yeah, F yeah," except she's not using F, of course. So apparently she liked the costume. So I get my stuff, I'm going out, you know, it's been kind of like, well, there's the capstone, you know, that's fun. As I'm turning the corner to go out of Walmart, I look over and I see an elderly gentleman come in, and he is scowling. I can tell from the look on his face, he is not happy about this. He is not happy that I have violated his visual space. How dare I wear something that he didn't approve of? So, as fairly typical, he gets all the way to where he's parallel with me, and he's starting to move on, because usually the scorn stuff happens on like a drive-by shooting. So he's moving on, and he says, "Well, you know, you look stupid." And I bust out laughing, because the answer to that, honestly, is, of course I look stupid. But it sure does make people laugh. So it's just such an easy crystallization of all the various attitudes that we have. And that's fine. Everybody's got a right to their own opinion, you know? It's fine. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. So it's good. It was fine. I mentioned that I was a little frustrated last night. I am doing this Grammarly edit. And as someone who likes to kind of plan things out, I had 3,500 mistakes I had to get through and either make corrections or ignore them in Grammarly. One would think that once you corrected something, it would stay corrected and you can move on to the next thing. So I'm watching my time, I'm running calculations, I'm seeing how long things are taking me, and I'm thinking, well, okay, so I can do about 4 a minute by the time sometimes I have to rewrite sentences, and sometimes I just ignore stuff. I'm feeling this is about 4 a minute, so 3,500, that means 4 divided is given about 800 minutes, you know, I'm calculating it all out, how many hours is it going to take, it's going to take about 4 hours a night, blah, 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 blah. Oh, man. I was up till 1 o'clock night before last, finally got my 900, because I needed 900 a night. Got it? Okay, going to bed. Just got started a little late, so I got started at like 8:30-ish. I finally just shut it down at 1:30, because I would make corrections, and I would track and say, okay, so I've got, you know, 1,000 more to do. You know, okay, so I've got, you know, 200 or 500 more to do. Okay, so I've got 300 more to do. Running, making a bunch of corrections. I mean, a bunch of corrections coming back. And supposedly I've only done 50. What are you talking about? What do you mean I've only done 50? And then I noticed it would do things like, I would say such and such particular, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it would say, well, you need a article on the front of that. So it would say a particular. Okay, great. So I put in a particular. And then I'd go on and crunch, 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 crunch. And then it'll come back and say, well, instead of a particular, you should say the particular. Okay, what? you just told me to put a particular on it, and I put it on it, and now you want the particular on it. And I'm sure if I would have put the particular on it, it would have come back and said, no, you need a particular. So as you're correcting mistakes, it's adding other mistakes back in. What? Stop it! So the 4 hours that I was supposed to spend doing this last night turned into 5 hours, and I still didn't get my 900 corrections in. I got 800, so I've got 1,000 to try to get through tonight. So I'll see if I can get through them. I really want to get through them. So I got to get home, got to get this uploaded, and then I got to hunker down and just go, 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 go. Anyways, but that's fine. I think I know what I'm doing for the cover. I think I've got pictures. We've got costumes for the kids. The idea is if tomorrow and Saturday I can get the customer or the cover knocked together without the kids, then we can shoot on Sunday. I can finish the book layouts first couple of days next week and get the books ordered, have them in, hopefully, before the 1st of October. Then we're good. So that's puttering along. The book turned out fine. I've got said a lot of the things I want to say. I think the epilogue's fine. Has some nice moments in it. So I think all in all, that's going well. The costumes are fun. They're just fun. You know, people seem to be enjoying them. I told you, I think I mentioned last week that I had come up with a different, a different costume. I needed something for the second week of October, and I found National Costume Swap Day. The idea is you're supposed to swap costumes with your neighbors so that you don't have to buy new costumes. My idea coming out of that was, you know what? I should just get like the 5 most popular costumes and just wear them all at the same time. So it'll be fun. But now I have International Day of the Ninja as well. So I've ordered a little outfit for that. I got to come up with something for that. I'm building the costume for World Kindness Day, which is the week after the week of the election. I think we're going to need World Kindness Day. It is ridiculous. It is just ridiculous. Have a great, great Halloween costume. I don't usually do Halloween, but Halloween is on a Saturday, which means I'm going to breakfast on that Saturday. Plus, you know, the Friday right before it is going to be close enough. I decided, you know what? I'm going to back up Crazy Paisley Day 1 week, and then we're going to do it. And it's just a great costume. I just love it so much. It's so fun. So, you know, and people seem to enjoy it. That's the thing. People seem to enjoy it. So, yeah, I feel like I'm accomplishing something with those costumes. And from the feedback that I get from people, it seems like I am. You know, when your dentist office calls and said, yeah, and you can wear a costume if you want to. Okay, I'll do that. You know, just seeing people's faces light up. Just light up and smile and laugh. It's good. It's good. It's like magic. It's just magic. So, I just stumbled into this. It wasn't like something I planned, but, you know, I'm doing the systems analyst stuff on gender, and I just stumbled into it. It's amazing. So, anyways, lots to do, but all is well. We're puttering along. I do have an article this week, and I'll go through this fairly quickly. I've actually got 12 pages of notes here, but we're just going to hit the high points on this, because what I'd like to talk about in this article is not necessarily the science, but I would like to talk about the religion surrounding the science, because I think this is telling. It's very, very telling. And it's amazing to me how this kind of stuff can go on and continuously goes on now, and yet, we still pretend that scientists are completely objective and that the scientific method is the way that science is done, and this just shows how much better the scientific method is than everything else. I am not against the scientific method. I think it is very good. I think it's a help when you can put something out, have it peer-reviewed, have repeatable exercises, you know, have hypothesis, have people trying to disprove things and prove things. All that's good. Peer-reviewed stuff, it's all good. It does not, however, inoculate us from prejudice. It does not inoculate us from the tendency to develop a herd complex where we say, well, the official known science and everything outside this sphere must be wrong. Even when there are clearly identified phenomena. So that's what this story is about. And it's about oysters. The title of this article is The Oysters That Knew What Time It Was. This article is written by... I think this is from a book, The Human Cosmos, Civilization, and the Stars by Joe Marchant. So, way back, 1954, 4 years before I was born, in February 1954, U.S. biologist named Frank Brown discovered something so remarkable, so inexplicable, that his peers essentially wrote it out of history. So he discovers something, and it does not fit with the peer science of the time. And so everyone just decides he's nuts. They just decide this, even though he has a verifiable experiment. So the experiment was this. Brown had dredged a batch of Atlantic oysters from the seabed off New Haven, Connecticut, and shipped them hundreds of miles inland to Northwest University in Evanston, Illinois. Then he put them into pans of brine in a sealed dark room, shielded from any changes in temperature, pressure, water currents, or light. Normally, these oysters feed with the tide. They open their shells to filter plankton and algae from the seawater, with the rest periods in between when their shells are closed. Brown had already established that they are most active at high tide, which arrives roughly twice a day. He was interested in how the mollusks time this behavior, so he devised the experiment to test what they would do when kept far from the sea and deprived from any information about tides. Would their normal feeding rhythms persist? For the first 2 weeks, it did. Their feeding activity continued to peak 50 minutes later each day, in time with the tides on the oysters' home beach in New Haven. That in itself was an impressive result, suggesting that the shellfish could keep accurate time. But then something unexpected happened, which changed Brown's life forever. The oysters gradually shifted their feeding times later and later. After 2 more weeks, a stable cycle appeared. But now it lagged 3 hours behind the New Haven tides. Brown was mystified until he checked the astronomical almanac. High tides occur each day when the moon is highest in the sky or lowest below the horizon. Brown realized that the oysters had corrected their activity according to the local state of the moon. They were feeding when Evanston, if it had been by the sea, would experience high tide. He had isolated those organisms from every obvious environmental clue, and yet somehow they were following the moon. Okay, well, that seems like an easily verifiable experiment. Well, the problem was that we were just coming into the time when scientists were starting to appreciate that living processes vary according to environmental cycles. And there was this idea that it was all because of internal clocks. It was strictly because of internal clocks. Because what else would there be? How would the body sense anything else besides internal clocks? What Brown's lone insistence was that organisms are plugged into the mysterious cosmic cues. And that was widely dismissed. They said, no, it's not. Okay, he's got experimental evidence. No, it's not. No, it's not. It's all an internal clock. It's all an internal clock. Okay, so... And the critics that he had never relented. This was in the 50s. And his decades of work were thrown out as flawed. Conventional scientific accounts barely mention him except as a cautionary tale, a warning about the dangers of straying too far from common sense. The field of chronobiology has since exploded with researchers uncovering, okay, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so you know, there's like a seminar. He goes to this seminar. He gives a talk at this seminar. And after he goes to this seminar and, you know, he talks about what he thinks he has discovered, all of a sudden, people don't want to work with him anymore. And like in 1957, there's this paper that's come out in a leading U.S. scientific journal, Science, in which a respected ecologist named Lamont Cole claimed that by juggling random numbers, he had discovered the exogenous rhythm of the unicorn. And they said the satire was aimed at Brown and his team, and its message was clear. Their results are as imaginary as the unicorn itself. It was an unprecedented personal attack, and it, quote, hit us very hard, Brown later recalled. We were everywhere encountering innuendos from this article. Okay? So, what you have here is ridicule. And you have everyone tut-tutting and saying, oh, well, yeah, see, blah, 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 blah. Okay, because everything needed to be gears of the clock and everything needed to be internal. And so they were having these big discussions. And so the industry was moving, the industry, the science was moving in that way. So the vision was that of circadian rhythms as internal, self-sustaining, controlled by oscillating biochemical mechanisms analogous to cogs and gears of a clock. Everything was looking good for the young field with its new terminology and a robust theoretical framework. There was just one problem. Brown. He wasn't invited at first, but he went anyway, the only speaker to argue for a core pacemaker driven instead by cosmic cues. He faced a largely hostile audience. And after that meeting, he notices that his papers are increasingly rejected and that others in the field now no longer cite his research. According to Brown, Hallberg eventually admitted at around this time, his rivals privately agreed to block, ignore, or discredit him for the sake of the field's development because they had decided on a dogma and they were religiously enforcing it. Really, that's what it comes down to. Whether or not that's correct, they certainly stepped back from engaging with Brown and his ideas. From then on, it was almost as if he didn't exist. Okay, well, that's all fine and well. Here's the thing, though. We keep going along. Lo and behold, there are fluctuations in the magnetic field, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there's actually... let me see if I can find examples. Okay. Just as these researchers were ignoring any links to magnetic fields, however, other biologists were being forced to address their effects despite the dubious connotations. These scientists were studying the impressive ability of many animals to navigate across the planet, from turtles and salamanders to birds and bees. How did millions of monarch butterflies each year find their way through thousands of miles from North America to a particular patch of fir groves in central Mexico? How did the female loggerhead turtles, after growing up in the open ocean, return to lay their eggs at the very same beach where they hatched more than 10 years early? How did racing pigeons fly straight home from distant places they had never visited? And all of a sudden, you know, people start looking and saying, you know, maybe there is something there. And they go on in the article talking about possible mechanisms for how we may be sensitive to magnetism. They talked about a bunker, that there was a bunker where they had one bunker that was just dark and quiet and yada yada, and the other bunker was completely isolated. You know, they had cork and they had electrical fields and they had stuff to keep and how that people behaved differently, even though visually it was all the same. That they were able to maintain some sort of a rhythm in the darkened room, but once you got them in this other room where the influence of electromagnetic fields was greatly reduced, that all of a sudden, you know, they started losing their way. So here we are, you know, in the 20-teens, and now we're recognizing, wow, maybe there is something here. Maybe people do sense. Maybe animals, maybe insects, maybe there is some ability to sense magnetic fields. And when the moon is rising and lowering, that's interacting with the magnetic field of the Earth, and you can feel those fluctuations. The article concludes with they're talking about the bunkers and things. Let's see. The discovery that biological clock machinery is sensitive to magnetism is still very new, and it's not yet precisely clear how or if magnetic fields are influencing our sense of time. One theory is that at least some species tell the time by using tidal variations in the Earth's field, just as Brown originally suggested. Others think the link may relate to how clocks resist temperature changes, a question posed by Brown and never fully answered. If you lose temperature compensation, you'd expect the body rhythms to continue, but to become less stable or more variable and start uncoupling, just as Weaver found in the bunker shielded from magnetic fields. Perhaps it is an external clue, after all. The Earth's magnetic field, as influenced by the sun and the moon, that enables biological clocks to run regardless of temperature. Not necessarily driving behavior directly, but providing a fundamental tick of the clock. So, here we are. We are 50, 70 years after this poor guy saw an observed phenomenon that could have been repeated. An observed phenomenon. And from that, he reaches a perfectly reasonable conclusion that there's something else going on besides a completely internal clock. It's a repeatable experiment. But because it does not fit the dogma of the day, a whole group of scientists just say no. And they, in essence, write him out of history. So, yes, the scientific method can certainly help us be more objective, but that doesn't mean the people involved as scientists are going to be more objective, because there's a whole lot more going on than just facts. This was a burgeoning field. They thought they had come up with a dogma that fit everything. You've got this other guy that's saying, no, you don't do it. You don't have it. It sounds like fantasy because they have no way to explain this. So how do they deal with this? As opposed to looking at the facts, they just decide he's wrong and he's a unicorn and he should be mocked and ridiculed and kicked out. No one should work with him. So that is not the response of objective science. That's the response of a religion. He was ostracized. He was excommunicated. Because he did not perform to the dogma and proclaim the dogma. So I think as human beings, we just have to be very, very careful when we decide we're right and everyone else is wrong and our opinion is the only opinion and it's the truth and everybody should just bow down to our truth. I think we should be very, very careful and always treat each other with kindness and always listen and always try to see others' viewpoints and always provide space for others to have other viewpoints. Okay? The woman in Walmart in the cowboy boots who was just so delighted with the costume that she said the F word multiple times as she was walking out in a delighted manner. She has a right to her opinion, just like the guy who wanted to let me know that I had to know that I look stupid. He has a right to his opinion too. That's just fine. Now, I wouldn't necessarily encourage us to bark at others as we're walking by and call them names and that sort of thing. But at least we can show grace to those who do that. Show grace. Smile, nod your head. I know what's going on inside him. I know why he didn't like my outfit. I know. It's fine. Okay? That doesn't mean I have to feel about it a certain way. I just think we could do a whole lot better. Just add a little more grace, a little more kindness. And you know what? we're gonna need it over the next multiple months. Oh, we're going to need grace and kindness over the next couple of months. So let's just practice now. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.